You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Eight oh eight here on a Tuesday morning. Mike McNamara with you. All Marine Radio continues. That means it's at 9:08 in Boise, Idaho, where our next guest lives, Charlie Linville. Charlie, first of all, good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
First of all, Charlie was the first I've seen wounded veteran. I've seen amputee. When you say you were the first, what do you say?
I was the first combat wounded veteran from any country to summit Everest.
The first combat wounded veteran from any country to summit Everest. And medically retired as a staff sergeant for the Marine Corps?
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about you. First of all, man, I can't tell you how fired up I was when I saw that news. It was like Marine, wounded Marine, first to summit Everest. I was like, boom, yeah! And so just on behalf of everybody, congratulations, thank you. And way to get the Eagle Globe and Anchor up there before those Army guys got there a week later.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty important to me, you know? The Marine Corps has always been first ahead of the Army, so my guy gets the train going.
Were you conscious of their effort and them trying to get there first?
Yeah, I knew about them, and I wish that good luck, and I wanted them to make the summit, but just not before me.
Nice. It never ends, man, does it?
No, the rivalry's deep. It's going to go for life. You know, that's the way it works.
I told somebody, they're like, you Marines, you guys are always talking shit. And, the Army, blah, blah, blah. I said, you know what? If we had our druthers, we'd really like to fight the Army someday and settle this for once and for all. You know, they could be in Colorado. We'll land in California. We'll get together someplace in Nevada. We'll whoop it on and we'll see. We'll figure this stuff out. They said, what? I said, yeah, we want a piece of those guys. But it's good to see the rivalry continues even to the top of Mount Everest. First of all, Charlie, born and raised where?
Born and raised in Boise, Idaho.
Born and raised in Boise, Idaho. So are you a Boise State guy, the blue AstroTurf and all that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the main sport around this town. So if you're not a Bronco, then there's something wrong with you.
If you're not a Bronco, that blue turf is so obnoxious. Come on.
It is, but, you know, hey, we had to do something in the 80s.
Exactly. The signature blue turf. The football team's been pretty good for a long time and pretty impressive coming out of a pretty small city in the United States. So you guys ought to be proud of it.
Yeah, keep going. This small town's pretty good.
All right, so you're born and raised in Boise. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Marine Corps gets on my radar because I was a punk. And I did a semester of college, and it just wasn't my thing. And we just happened to be in Iraq and Afghanistan at the time. And I had a buddy that joined, and just like, why not do something else? This isn't working.
And so being a punk, you thought, where can I find other punks? Is that how you got? That looks like where some badasses hang out. Because let me tell you, there's a lot of Marines that join for that reason, right?
There are, definitely. I joined because I wanted to go serve my country. I was going to war and going to combat. And then it's like, you got your choices. Well, I want to be in the infantry, so I'm going to go with the baddest guys that are, and that's the Marine Corps. And so I had no doubts. I would have been Marine Corps recruiting office said, I want to be the infantry. If you don't get it, if you can't tell me that today, then I'm out of the door. And he's like, whoa.
So you were
giving the old silver tongue talk of the recruiter and I had the infantry. So
you were even a punk in the recruiter's office?
Yes.
And then he hooked you right into the infantry. Nice.
Yeah.
So no family members, Marines, or were in the military?
My grandfather was in World War II, but after that, nobody.
As a Marine?
Service. No, he was in the Army. He was in the European campaign. But anyway, after that, nobody. And then I actually told my dad that I was joining Marine Corps. He told me it was a horrible mistake. And I laughed and went to boot camp, and it turned out quite well.
You know, I my dad had similar lousy things to say. He told me that Marines were stupid. They can't pour piss out of a boot. I graduated from college. I'm working for Merrill Lynch, and I kind of like he said, so how do you like work? I said, I don't. I'm looking for a new job. He said, you know what? He said, you got to be happy doing what you do. And I said, you know, that's what I'm looking for, just something that I love. He said, no. I said, that's great. And, you know, my dad was in Major League Baseball, so it's like, he's going, where are you going today? Yankee Stadium? Like, oh, that's rough. So, I mean, it's kind of like a bad role model because his job's too fun. And so he said, so what do you think about doing? I said, I think I'm going to join the Marine Corps. Dead silence on the phone. He says, what? He said, no, no. He goes, they're stupid. They can't pour piss out of a boot. I said, oh, really? We're going to go there? But I would get, my thoughts are similar. It turned out pretty good and the best team I ever played on. So when do you, so what year are you, did you enlist?
Early 2006.
2006. So the war's going on and you know you're going to fight.
Yeah. I knew that's where I was headed. I mean, I asked to be in the job that's on the front lines and, it's what I wanted to do. I didn't, if I was going to join the Marine Corps and be in the military, I was going to be in the military.
So you join and you get sent to 3-5, and do you do their deployment to Fallujah that year?
Yep. Went to Fallujah, had a wonderful time. Oh, it's a beautiful place. I'm being facetious, obviously.
I know. Well, and at the time we were clearing. In fact, I just talked to, I had an intel officer that was with, I was with RCT-5 at Camp Fallujah, and I ran the COC there. And so, you know, I'd watch you guys, what you were doing, you know, and shoot, clear air missions, medevac, and do all that stuff that you do when you're running a COC. And so, 3-5 was part of the push up, a route called Michigan between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they were rooting that place out, on a fairly regular basis. They also killed a dude that had a sniper rifle that was taken from 2-4 Marines in 2004 that was pretty significant to us in terms of retribution, and we loved that.
Yeah.
And then Route Michigan had IEDs everywhere, and we had not gotten up that area. I mean, we had fought in Ramadi and Fallujah, but the space between it, we hadn't really messed with till 3-5 went up there. So that's what you did. What part of the battle space were you in, Charlie?
I was in the southern part, man, I didn't think this far back, actually just out of Bahria.
Okay.
Trying to think, I can't remember the actual, the area.
Now, there was one company from 3-5 that when the army pulled a lot of their forces into Baghdad for their part of the start of the surge, 5th Marines got more battle space, and one company from 3-5 went over, I want to say, to 1-1. Were you part of that company?
No.
Okay.
We stayed. So I joined those six. There was the initial push. I wasn't in that.
Right.
3-5 went to Fallujah 4 straight times.
Right,
so.
Right. Loved it so much.
Yeah.
They went back. The 2006 deployment. I want to ask you, you know, do you stay in touch with those 3-5 guys through Mark Soto's the boys of 3-5 page?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, those are my brothers for life. I mean, after Iraq and the political deployment, I switched to EOD, but I mean, I've been in contact with those guys through Mark and Facebook pretty much since I got out. So,
did you go to the reunion that they just had, or were you probably no? You were probably working, huh?
Yeah, I did, and I've been training and doing things for the last 3 years. That's pretty much consumed my entire life.
All right, so so you do that deployment were you a PFC Lance Corporal at the time?
Lance Corporal, and got promoted to Corporal of Combat.
Meritoriously promoted?
Yeah.
You know, there's no, I don't think, greater honor that a Marines bestow on other Marines than to be meritoriously promoted in combat. That had to feel good, huh? That by virtue of the way you conduct yourself in contact with the enemy, you know, we're now going to make you a leader.
Yeah, it was, it felt really good at the time. And, and really stepping up and, you know, having to go from Lance Corporal to actually start leading the squad, you know, it was an interesting role to be thrusted in combat, but, you know, I welcomed it with open arms and,
you know, really helped me develop as a person.
Can you describe what that responsibility is like when you have to be the guy who starts telling people, you know, hey, around that corner, hey, do this, hey, do that, and it's your decisions where really the rubber meets the road for the Marine Corps? Can you describe what that responsibility was like?
Yeah, at first it was big shoes, you know, when you realize that, you know, you get the mission briefing and then you go tell your squad what's going on and then you leave the wire and you're essentially responsible for, you know, we were running trucks at the time, so there's 20 guys, you're responsible for everybody and all the equipment and whatever happens out there, if you get into a tick, troops in combat, you know, it's like, if contact, it's, all the decisions on you. It was a big burden, but it felt great to be there in the moment and leading, you know, America's finest warriors into combat and just, you know, being successful. It's a great learning experience and you know, as far as learning how to be a leader, I love how the Marine Corps does it.
Talk to us about, did you suffer any casualties with your guys that you were leading, and what was that like?
You know, on that deployment, it was pretty pretty relaxed, so there wasn't a whole lot going on. So I was fortunate that we didn't suffer any casualties out of my platoon, and it was you know, I was happy. We were all happy to go home at the end of the day, knowing that all of our brothers are with us.
I've got an email question for you. My guest this morning, Staff Sergeant Charlie Linville from Boise, Idaho, first wounded veteran to get to the summit of Mount Everest. Did that about a month ago?
Almost, yeah, 3 weeks.
And he joins us here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio. And Charlie, first of all, thanks for doing this. I love doing these interviews. Awesome to talk to Marines about not only their combat experiences, but the things they do afterwards. So you come back from the 2006 deployment. You're a corporal, promoted in combat. What was next for you?
You know, I got back and it was just like surveying the landscape of the battalion. And as always, you get back and people start going different places and doing different things, and that's the Marine Corps. And I didn't really like where my battalion was going, and I'd really worked closely with EOD in Fallujah and watching their job and helping them remove some of their found UXO really sparked my desire to do that. Like, I didn't even realize it was a job. It was possible to do something like this in the Marine Corps,
right?
Because I was, you know, a young Marine. I didn't really know what was out there. And so when I got back, I really decided to start pursuing doing a lateral move to EOD, and I got the packet together and, you know, submitted all my stuff and went and did the interview, and I eventually got accepted. So I was pretty excited about moving on to the next chapter of my Marine Corps career.
And so that happens, what, 2009?
Yeah, 2009.
All right, so 2009, what's the training? How long is the training pipeline before you can actually go out and work?
The school itself is 8 months, and the attrition rate, I think, is like 50%.
Oh, really?
There. So, yeah, you get in there, and you just hope that you're academically qualified to pass all the tests. And so it did 8 months and got my duty station. I was told I was going to Okinawa, Japan, and so picked my family up and flew to Japan, which is all a new experience, and started to learn how to be an EOD tech.
All right, so you're and how long were you in Japan? So 2009, and then you head to what? You head to Afghanistan in 2010, yeah?
Yep, we were there for about a year. I worked really hard to get on the next deployment. I wanted to get out of there as fast as possible.
All right, so and then what rank were you, sergeant at the time? Pick up sergeant?
Yeah, I was sergeant at the time.
Okay, and then when did you deploy to Afghanistan?
When did we deploy to Afghanistan? We deployed September 2010.
Okay, September 2010. Really, that's we might have been on the same flight. We got there late August. We were south of you down in the Marja area. So
we flew into Marja. I started with Marja in 2009.
Really?
And then, yeah, really.
Nice, then we're battle buddies.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Marja was a shithole. I mean, there was IEDs everywhere, and wasn't it?
That was fantastic, boy. Come on, all these places were wonderful. They're like on my top travel
list. So you think you'll be taking your family back there for a battlefield tour someday?
One day, absolutely. Like, this is what Dad has on IED.
Nice. Describe Mars for people that have never been to Afghanistan or never seen pictures. What's Mars in that area? Because, I mean, it was a city that was in the news a fair amount. So what's the terrain like? What are the cities like? What's Mars like?
Oh, man. We were kind of on the Sistani Peninsula with the 81, so it was just nothing but, like, farmland and open desert, and there's irrigation canals with, you know, the typical Afghanistan mud huts and mud wall compounds. I never really made it into the city because I was so busy, honestly, out dealing with IEDs buried in the desert or buried around my company's area of operations. So, I mean, it was just miserable.
So 2-9, I just got an email from a friend of mine listening. Mac, did he just say Sistani Peninsula? I just had a flashback. I haven't heard that name in years. Yeah, that's what he said, Sistani Peninsula. There was the part of Mars that stuck out into kind of the desert. And there was a lot of nefarious stuff trafficking through there and moving through there. So, and 2-9 was trying to get that thing under control at about that time. So that's awesome, Charlie. We're battle buddies, man. Talk to us about the complexity of IEDs that you dealt with in that area there. What were most of the IEDs made of?
Most of them were, VO, victim operated, you know, pressure plates. Yeah, things of that nature, but there were a fair amount of command debt as well. Those are really the two major ones. You know, we're always concerned about RCIDs when we carry the electronic countermeasures around, right? But those were few and far between. I mean, most of them were VO, pressure plates, and command debt. And the complexity of them, I mean, thank goodness they're not really sophisticated because that would not be fun to take apart every day.
Right.
But for us, it was just the magnitude, the amount that you could find. You know, you show up to an area, and you find one, and you know there's like three more around you somewhere. You're like, okay, where are the rest of you?
Talk to us. I've got a text message. Matt, could you ask Charlie, for those of us who've never deployed, could you ask him to describe a typical IED, its components, and then how they bury it and conceal it? So, Charlie, go ahead.
Yeah, so a typical IED is just a jug of some sort to put the HME, homemade explosive, inside of. So that's the bulk charge. And then they're going to have some sort of initiation switch. So, I mean, you're going to have your blasting cap that has wires that are running out to either the pressure plate. The pressure plate's made of wood or some sort of non-metallic material. And then there's either thin copper wires in there or they've taken some carbon rods out of a battery and they run it to their power source. It's either D cells or using 9-volt batteries that are stacked together in series. And then they use a bunch of packing tape and they wrap it as much as they can to try to waterproof it once they put it in the ground. And then the power source is offset usually. So we can't find it with a metal detector, and that's generally what the guys step on is something that's constructed of, you know, in that manner. The rest of them, again, they have their big, large container holding them of their bulk HE, and then whether it's got wire that's running 800 meters to a motorcycle battery or what, and then RCIEDs or anything from cell phones, key fob, garage door opener, I mean, just anything that has a electronic radio frequency that they can use to detonate it.
All right. And then when you say offset, so what the Marine is searching for and what they'll step on in terms of, let's just talk about pressure plates, that's constructed of wood. There's got to be some wire to it, yes? Because it's got to be...
Yeah, some of them are low mag, and that's why it's the carbon fiber rods.
Right.
They conduct electricity, and then once you step on it, obviously it completes the circuit, which makes the explosion go off.
Right.
But they got more sophisticated, and they started
so you can see the challenge of doing that every day and going out and clearing that stuff, and for Marines to first see it and then or detect it, not an easy thing to do. At what point do you transition from 2-9 and head up north to Sangin?
We transition, I think, pretty soon. I think we're like 6 weeks in. That's at the point that 3-5 was just getting hammered and Sangin.
Right.
And there was 10 EOD techs up there, and they were, you know, getting wounded as well. And so as our EOD tech numbers became depleted, I obviously was chomping at the bit to get up to Sangin because that's my old infantry battalion, and I had to know where all my buddies are, and I want to be there with them on deployment supporting them. So I lobbied pretty hard to get up there.
So you go up there and got to feel good to be with your old battle buddies, huh?
Yeah, it was great to see everybody and just, you know, be with them. And, you know, unfortunately they had lost, you know, a lot of guys at that moment already. And then, you know, some of them were my friends. And so I had to go up there. You can talk about retribution. I felt like I needed to be up there. I didn't care what I was going to do. I was going to get rid of as many IEDs as I possibly could find.
You know, you want to talk about retribution? You know, when we lose Marines, there's not a whole lot we can do to bring them back. But there's the one thing we can do is we can go find who did it, and we can go find everybody involved with them and either kill them or capture them. And so when you do go to a memorial service 10 days or so later, you could stand there and, you know, it's not a great feeling, but at least it's small comfort to know that, hey, anybody that was involved with this no longer walks the face of the earth. So retribution in combat is no, I mean, you have to keep it under control, but it's certainly a motivating factor. Yes, Charlie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Marine Corps has got a predicate on that, right? Take the fight to them, right?
Right.
So when you lose a good friend of yours, I mean, you're going to take the fight to these, you know, individuals that are just horrible people, and you're going to wipe them off the face of the earth. And, you know, it makes you feel good in that respect. Obviously, not taking it too far in war. I mean, we have rules of engagement and this, that, and the other. But when you are able to locate, close with, and destroy the individual that just took your friend from you and took a son, a father, you know, it feels great.
My guest, Charlie Linville, Staff Sergeant, Infantryman with 3-5, EOD guy in Afghanistan, and we're talking about his time there. Charlie, we've got to take about a 3-minute break. We'll come back and then talk about how you were wounded, and then we'll get into, you know, your what I really want to talk about is I read a quote from you that said that you need Everest was important to you because you needed a bigger challenge, something that could make I'll simplify the quote, the pain that you had experienced and what it was like to come back from that. You needed a bigger challenge to make that go away. Is that? Can you tell me what you said before we go to the break?
Yeah, I mean, I've said a lot of different stuff, but honestly, I needed a bigger challenge to figure out who I was after my injury. You know, and I said I kind of had these demons of war that because I'm no longer as capable when I was a Marine, and so I needed something to prove to myself and I guess to others that, you know, I'm capable of just as much now that I'm missing a limb.
Well, let me just tell you, I'm not sure that I get up to the top of Everest right now. So, I think you might have proved your point. All right. Staff Sergeant Limbo, he's going to hold on with us. We're going to take a quick break, come back and, talk about how he was wounded, the aftermath of that. We're going to talk about combat related mental health and then, his rise to the top of Mount Everest. The first wounded American, first wounded from any country person to get up to the top of Mount Everest. Certainly proud of that. We'll continue that discussion next right here on All Marine Radio on a Tuesday edition on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had PTSD. Once I was back from Iraq, I was distant from everybody in my family. We had a reunion of our unit, and you hear these spouses say, "Is your husband doing that? My husband's doing that too. I thought it was just us." And really understanding that, hey, this is a common experience.
I learned more to listen to what he was saying, and it made it easier for me to understand where his pain was coming from.
Warriors should know that resources are available. Learn more at realwarriors.net.
You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. B-35 on a Tuesday on the West Coast, 11:35 on the East Coast, 9:35 where Charlie Linville lives in Boise, Idaho. You like living in Boise? I mean, you grew up there. I mean, I guess you got to say yeah. But
it's nice.
It's all right.
And it's funny you ask. I'm not going to be here for about, you know, another year. I'm moving to Oregon, but I love it here.
Why are you moving to Oregon?
I'm going to go to Bend. The school system is a little better for my kids in Bend. And the overall recreation, my outdoor recreation, it's just closer. And the weather's a little more temperate.
Did you just say temperate?
Yeah.
Nice. Wow. All right. He's a grunt, too, folks. He said temperate. You could look it up if you have to. we continue here talking to Charlie Linville. Marine Staff Sergeant, Grunt EOD guy, first to summit Everest, and what a story that made world headlines. And he's gracious enough to come on, and he knew he had to, All Marine Radio. Hey, if we got a radio station, you know you got to be on it, Charlie.
Yeah, well, you know, at least it wasn't All Army Radio, Colin.
Exactly. Hey, guess what? I'm starting that, too. So we're going to do it because, you know, the bottom line of this radio station is post-combat-related mental health. So
yeah.
We want to help, but Marines are going to own it, bottom line that for you. So just so, and then they know it. Like, yeah, go figure. Anyway, let's talk about, how'd you get wounded? Tell us about that day, what happened. And
So I got wounded on a call, where a Marine had stepped on an IED and unfortunately was severely wounded. And so, you know, part of EOD's job is not just to take apart IEDs. Whenever an IED goes off, we go out and do a post-blast analysis, so we figure out what happened, why it happened, was there a way that we as Marines can do something better, you know, to make sure that we mitigate our combat losses. And showed up and got about 100 yards away, and bam, another IED goes off. A combat engineer stepped on yet another IED that's over in this field. And so at which point everybody kind of freezes, you know, it's like, oh, no,
right.
We're in a minefield, and just waited for us to show up. And when we showed up, it got a little heated. The MT guys were a little stressed out, and we kind of got in an argument, which didn't help. And then a lot of times that I was there.
Hey, Charlie, what would you argue about?
Oh, they were just. When EOD shows up, it's kind of like this interesting dynamic, right? It's like that sometimes guys think that we're going to find everything in the ground, and that's just not possible.
Right.
You know, like I can show up and kind of clear places, but I can't say, yeah, this is 100% clear. You can just go do whatever you want, you know, like in this area. Like, I swept it. I'm reasonably certain there's nothing here, but, you know, if it's a nomad, I'm not going to be able to find it. I don't have X-ray vision. Anyway, we showed up and they were just stressed out from the two Marines that just had lost both their legs. I mean, two Marines just lost both their legs. So it was just this chaotic situation that we walked into, and they wanted us to do something, and we have protocol, we have procedures that we do when we show up, and we're not going to deviate from them because somebody's telling us otherwise. And so that's what the argument was about.
Right.
And it was just a stressful situation. And so we show up to it a lot, and so we're used to it, but anyway, there was some arguing going on, and then Marine gear kind of goes everywhere in a violent explosion, right?
Right.
And I don't leave it. I refuse to leave anything on the battlefield, so I was sweeping out to the Marine's gear, and I had my metal detector out, and bam! I didn't hear it, didn't see it, and that was that.
So you're, when do you wake up? Were you conscious while they were treating you?
30 seconds later, it was quick. I mean, I remember stepping out. I remember going up and then, like, coming down, slightly disoriented and just like, ooh. I know I stepped on an IED and my hand was killing me. And so I first evaluated, you know, what I could see because I was kind of laying back on the ground, on my back on the ground. And I realized that two of my fingers were mangled on my hand. And I was like, okay, that is what it is. And then my foot was killing me, so I had to look down. Fortunately, the IED didn't have a high-order detonation. That means the HME inside didn't fully detonate or go off. And so only the top portion of the IED went off, so it really just turned into like a soap opera. Only like, you know, two to four pounds or something went off. And so instead of...
And typically, Charlie, how much HME was in that IED?
That one, I believe, is... I didn't do the post-blast. I think it was 10 to 15 pounds.
All right, so...
So that's enough that my hand was down with my metal detector for me to be a triple amputee. So I should be a triple amputee.
Wow.
And I'm not. And it really just crushed my foot and just... I mean, it was still, my foot was still attached to my body, and it was just sawdust on the inside.
Okay, so you have damaged your foot, damaged your hand, but you're conscious the whole time that you go through the medevac process?
Correct. I wake up, and my other EOD bubbas swept over to me and, you know, kind of did a check to make sure that was my only injuries.
Right.
At which point the medevac bird was called and came and picked me up. And I remember the whole like 30-minute flight to Bastion, which, you know, attached to the leather neck.
Right.
And getting into Bastion and them injecting me with ketamine, which is a hell of a drug. The pain went from horrible to non-existent. Having a conversation with this British bloke, asking him where he's from. And then I remember I'm taking off my glove and my finger is just like hanging by the skin.
Right.
And I looked up at him. I was like, can I keep those? Like, no, you can't keep them. I was like, come on.
They're mine.
Yeah, they're mine. I was born with them. They're mine.
They're mine. They belong to me.
I mean, I don't want the flesh. I just want the bones, right? Because I can make like a necklace out of them. Come
nah,
on.
That, you know, this string of you being a punk seems to follow you throughout your whole life, Charlie.
Oh, it's really not a punk anymore. I'm just a smart ass.
Really? All right. So, and then obviously, they probably sedated you and they, you head to Germany.
Yeah. They sedated me. I went into cleanup surgery in, Bastion. I remember waking up and getting on the last C-130 out of Afghanistan on the way to Germany. And man, what a miserable flight. Good night. No one's been on a medevac flight, at least out of there. It was horrible.
Why?
You're stacked in the C-130. You're with guys from, bad injuries to, like, you know, the worst of the worst. You know, double, triple amputee guys that are just totally, you know, medically induced coma and sedated. And I remember the guy on top of me, my nose was touching his litter. And, it was just this horrible flight. And then somebody mismarked my pain meds, and so I had to make the flight without pain meds. I was just like, felt like I was in a fire the whole time, just burning. I was like, you know what? This is miserable.
Hey, let me tell you, if I want to say the Washington Post flew on one of those flights and kind of did this pictorial essay of it. And, unless you're on one, you don't know what they are, but what are they, C-17s, and they have, I mean, literally there's guys stacked in stretchers and litters from the floor, you know, to, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 feet up, and they've got all this medical technology in there, and then there's seats on the side, the centerways open so that the medical people that are flying with them can walk in and walk around and check them. I was blown away when I saw it, but I can, and how long is that flight? You're going to Germany from Afghanistan.
Yeah, go ahead. The C-130 was the bad flight. So I don't remember how long that flight was, but from Germany back to America, you're on a C-17.
Okay.
I know they're spacious, for the critical patients. I mean, there's an entire, critical care team. So there's like four people to one Marine.
Wow.
To make sure that they're stabilized and they, you know, they make it back to America to, Walter Reed, or Bethesda. And those flights and those planes you talked about are amazing. I mean, I remember being in it, being conscious of just seeing everything that was going around. But the C-130 flight out of out of Afghanistan. I never want to do that flight ever in my life.
Nice.
Again.
Nice. Talk to us about the rehab part of your. And again, we're talking to Charlie Linville. If you have a question or comment, you can send a text to, and I've got a text a question for you. 714-661-8107. You can email us at live.allmarineradio@gmail.com, or you can, if you want to call and talk, you can call it 714-884-4294. Text message, Mac, button popping, proud of Charlie. What a man. Very proud of his service to the Marine Corps and the country. Does he have any advice for fellow amputees that might be struggling? He seems like he's bounced back pretty quickly. So we're getting to that part, Charlie. But now that you're a national, story, you have advice for other guys that as they kind of bounce back and live with an amputation?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really the whole reason I did Everest, right? I mean, for me, I found myself in a place of great depression, and I didn't know what I could do. Like, for me, life was just miserable, and I kind of had to bumble my way through and figure out that, okay, I have these injuries now, but these injuries aren't going to take away from my life. Like, we all get one life, and there's so many things left on my list. And I had to make the conscious choice, stop staying in my house, and just get up and, start. I took my daughters to the park, to start playing with the park and getting used to my prosthetic limb and the pain that it caused me. And then I started to enjoy being outside, and then recreational therapy was huge for me. Like, I would go fishing. I would just get out of the house. If I could do anything to get out of my house, because I realized when I was in the house, I fell back into this depressive state, and I really hated my life. And so as I challenged my own self to get up every day and not go from the bed to the couch or just hang out and eat, I found out that, my love and passion for life came back, and then it was just figuring out how to use the body that I have and use the limbs that I have. And so I made it a goal every day to not give up. I mean, when I was training for Everest, I didn't want to go to the gym, so I was in the gym for 6 hours a day. Some days I was like, nope, not going. But then I realized that I was going to go climb Everest, and if I didn't train, I was going to die. So,
good,
for me, it was really
good motivation,
right? For me, it was just taking that first step of courage to get out of the house. I mean, all of my brother and sister Marines out there, like, we all took the courage and volunteered to join the military. I mean, nobody was drafted. We all took the courage to volunteer and use that same courage that while you're in the military to walk out the door to set a goal, and not a goal that's can be accomplished next week. You need to set a goal that can be accomplished in, a year or whatever. And you'll find that if you set a goal, walk out your door, and go towards that goal, you're going to accomplish so much along the way, and you're going to realize that you have your life back.
Charlie Linville, our guest. Charlie, I want you to elaborate on, because it seems to me, the more I interview Marines that have been wounded and the more I'm around them, the hardest step to take is the first one you talk about taking, which is to get up off the couch and go outside, go to the park with your daughters. And then, and you're not, you're still a Marine. All the qualities that you have as a human being that took you to the Marine Corps, that got you into the grunts, that made you a punk, right, that got you to want the challenge of being an EOD guy, knowing, and then you had seen him operate, knowing all the danger, you're still that guy. But it's kind of buried under a lot of physical pain, a lot of emotional trauma, and then coming back and, wanting to be the guy you used to be, but you're not that guy anymore. Talk about those first steps, and do you have any advice for guys that are struggling with that first step?
Yeah, find a support structure. I mean, one of the biggest issues, at least for myself, I hope that other people can relate, but when I got out of the Marine Corps, I came home, and I can't relate to my friends from high school anymore. Like, I came home to my hometown, right? And I don't relate with any of them anymore that weren't in the military. Like, there's just nothing. They come and they ask the questions like, what was war like, this, that, or the other? Just the typical questions, but we can't relate on that level. Like, I can kind of tell them some stories, but as far as them understanding, they just don't get me anymore. They don't get my humor, their camaraderie that I had in the Marine Corps. It disappeared, that whole Marine Corps support structure. I mean, we still have it via Facebook, I think, but as far as having somebody to come over and just, you know, be your buddy and just there, I mean, whatever issue you're going through, that's gone. And so, you know, I had to figure out how to get past that and go out into the community and find other veterans that were here as a support system. Like, find a veteran that wants to go to the gym and, you know, go to the gym with him. Because I needed to be physically fit. I mean, I didn't want to get out of the Marine Corps and lose that mentality, you know, wake up for PC every morning. I still do that. But just being a part of your community, get out, be with other veterans, find somebody that relates to you that you can talk to, and then it really, I mean, I'll harp on it again, you gotta take the courage to walk out the front door. I mean, my house is fantastic, but I can't sit in it very long anymore because that's not where I want to be. I want to be out living my life. And now finding other veterans in my community and pulling them out and doing the same thing, my new mission. But rather for people struggling, just you gotta walk out the front door. I know there's a lot kicking around in our heads and sometimes our hearts are awfully heavy and life isn't what we wanted. But that doesn't necessarily mean you can't make it what you want. But it takes effort. It takes strength that every Marine has, but you got to do it.
As long as we're talking about post-combat mental health, I want to stay there. The Commandant says, you know, we don't look at each other and say, hey, man, how's your head? You know, we say, hey, man, you PT today. Hey, you look like you gained weight. But we don't say, how's your head? So, Charlie, talk about the journey of your head from, you know, coming back, all the different questions. You know, how do you support your family, right? What's going to happen to me? A lot of questions when you come back, yes?
Yeah, huge questions and a lot of doubts. And then being, you know, wounded in combat and dealing with, you know, all the pain and all this that's going on, it's really wreaking havoc through your entire life and family. Care whether you're a single guy and trying to deal with it, or you're married, or, you know, there's a lot going on, at least for me. And when I finally slowed down, I mean, Operation Tempo had been high for years. And when I finally slowed down, I was stuck in a hospital bed. I had to deal with all the stuff that Marines were very good at compartmentalizing, right? Go to combat, you kind of stuff it in places that you don't talk about.
Yeah, wall it off.
Yeah, ignore it. It doesn't exist. Didn't happen. They don't need to. I don't need to think about it anymore. But the funny part is, when we go to sleep, we can't turn the filter off, right? I mean, you can.
Hello.
Someone have it on when you're awake. Well, you go to sleep, and all these things that you're dealing with, and your body and your brain is trying to process. But yet we're great at being stuck in this world because we don't want to deal with it, and we're taught to. Just keep going. But as things slow down, or even if you're still in the Marine Corps, it affects you. It wears you down, it breaks you down, and slowly but surely you're not the same person you used to be if you ignore it. And so for me personally, I found myself yelling at my family. My kids were unhappy. My wife was unhappy. I was miserable. I didn't want to be there. And my wife sat me down and one day it said, you need help. And if you don't get help, we're not going to be here much longer because this is not life. And so I started going to mental health 3 times a week at first because clearly there was something going on that needed to be resolved. And I'm very glad I did, you know. I had to find a way to be at peace with a lot of the things that happened. And I feel very fortunate that my wife just had to come to Jesus moment, like, figure it out, because you're going to end up dead if you keep doing this.
I want to ask you, one of the great criticisms, and I just heard it again yesterday here from a Lance Corporal who probably saved 20 Marines and 10 Iraqis in Ramadi in 2005. He said, you know, they were the VA said it was frustrating for me because they were willing to medicate me, but I needed somebody to talk to, somebody that could help me get through this stuff. And I kept having to tell my story to somebody new every time I went. You sound like you had a different experience, Charlie. Did you? I mean, were you your experience going to therapy pretty good?
I was fortunate in the fact that I started going to mental health when I was still in a military hospital from my injuries sustained in Afghanistan. So I was there for a year and a half. So my mental health provider was the same person every time at first. And I can see the issue when you get out now, having seen both sides of the fence. The VA does create some issues there. I still go to mental health, but I had to stop going to the VA because I didn't feel that the VA mental health provider really cared. It was just somebody that went in there and was just, sure. I just felt that, you know, if you're there to listen and help, then help. But it's not the vibe that I got when I went in there. And so I actually found a veterans outreach group in the community, and that's where I go. And then I met veterans through there. And sometimes I won't even go to an actual provider. I'll just, you know, call up the guys I've met and go have a beer with them and just talk about stuff over a beer. And sometimes that's the most therapeutic thing for myself anyway.
So let me ask you this. I've been groping, and I even just had a conversation this morning before we came on the air with Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, Navy Cross winner, and talked to him. And I said, so what advice do you give Marines when they get out? They do what we tell them to, right? Go to the VA. Yet the experience, and Workman's coming on tomorrow, and I'll tease the story. He wound up getting a therapist fired for what she said to him. And you're going to have to listen tomorrow. That's the whole point of the tease. But it's these guys are engaged. He wins a Navy Cross in Fallujah doing, as you don't win the Navy Cross for nothing.
Right.
I mean, doing crazy stuff. And he goes to his, and his therapist tells him something that makes his head explode and gets her fired. And so my question to him was, so what do you tell Marines when they go to the VA and they don't get the help they need? Where do they go? And your answer is, look for a veteran outreach program in your community.
Absolutely, and I think every community needs to have them. I mean, I guess I'm, again, fortunate to be in Boise, Idaho, where there was a clear decision that obviously the VA wasn't doing exactly what they needed, and some veterans didn't want to go to the VA, so they created the Veterans Center. And so the Veterans Center has the school of educated counselors that are there for that purpose.
Are those guys veterans?
Some of them are. A lot of them are. But it's the VA can't access their system, so they talk to the VA. But
no, let me tell you, that's where I went. That's when I started getting therapy. When I thought I was losing it, I went to a vet center, and the guy who I spoke to was a Vietnam guy. Won 5 Bronze Stars and 2 tours in Vietnam. An infantry guy. And I sat down and unloaded on him, and he looked at me and he says, "Mac, you're really effed up." And then we both started laughing, and I said, "I know." And he said, "Hey, we'll get you to a better place." But you know what I mean, Charlie? It was like going home, because just the stuff in his office, a helmet, right? Bronze Stars, right? All of his I Love Me shit. And, you know, I have an I Love Me wall. I mean, we all do. And it was home, and you know, he had fought, and so he knew what he knew it, and it felt good, as opposed to talking to somebody who doesn't have any common experience. And so, wow. So, and the vet centers were built for that. They were outreach, and when you walked into a vet center when they originally did it, you were going to see a veteran. And that's why it became such a used place among veterans, because when I was first told about it, it was like, you walk in and the guy's going to have a ponytail, going to have a jean jacket with no sleeves, going to be a veteran. And you're going to walk in and he's going to look up and say, "Hey, man, what's up?" And you're going to feel good about being there. And it sounds like you had the same experience I did, which was, it was a good experience. And so I kept going back and got me to a better place.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Hey, Charlie, we got to take another break. And are you going anywhere?
Nope.
All right.
We're good. I'll be back after the break.
All right. There you go. I don't need to say anything. Hey, are you an Eminem guy?
Yeah. Yeah, man, I listen to all kinds of music.
All right.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy, crazy.
I wanted to fame, but not the cover of news.
What did you think when you heard that song the first time?
What's up?
What did you think when you heard Eminem's song "The Monster"? Where she's did you think they wrote that for you?
No, but it's a catchy song. I sing it a lot.
The first time I heard it, I laughed. I thought they wrote that for us, man. I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. That's us, man. Anyway, all right. We continue with Charlie Lindell right after this on the All Warrior Radio Network.
As we recognize the service of America's men and women in uniform, let's also honor the families who sacrifice so much every day. Military families endure frequent deployments and separations. They carry on while their loved ones are sent into harm's way and wait patiently for their safe return. If you really want to honor a veteran, look for ways to support their families and thank them for their sacrifices. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Number 4 on a Tuesday. We continue. Emailer writes this, Mac, I'm loving this interview. I don't even care if you get to the Everest part or not. This is great stuff. So, Charlie, nice going. You're getting good reviews already.
Well, that's good. Users are horrible.
My guest, you know what? But, hey, you're back with your tribe, man. So, you know, it's all good. We speak the same language. I mean, what the hell? Who else is going to know where the Sistani Peninsula is?
Yeah, right? I know. I got blown up there a few times.
Awesome. All right, Charlie Lindell. You know him because you read headlines about him that he went to the top of Mount Everest. Right? But you're getting to know him as a Marine, as an infantry Marine, as a leader of Marines, as an EOD guy, and then also as a veteran now who's looking to help other guys. So a privilege for us to have him on today. And Charlie, I got to tell you, your story is an awesome one. And we'll get to the Everest stuff, but you alluded to something that said that you're trying to do this for other veterans, get them out of the house. So I want to ask you about that. What exactly are you doing?
Well, so when you get wounded, you end up at one of the major military hospitals.
Right.
And at the time that I was wounded, there just happened to be hundreds of other amputees at the hospitals, and so you find yourself in a similar situation that other guys are in, and I'm a people watcher, you know, I kind of see what I'm doing and have people tell me what I'm doing, but I watch all these other guys, and it became quite evident that, you know, not all, but some of them were having struggles with their injury, much as same as I was, and I watched the guys go to physical therapy and just kind of their whole demeanor, whether they're in their wheelchair or, you know, they were just walking on their prosthetic limbs for the first time, you could just kind of tell that they weren't enjoying life. They weren't into it. They were just doing it because they had to. And they would go back and play video games, and their life was just this monotonous thing that they were stuck in. And I didn't want life to be that way, and I certainly didn't want that for other Marines that, you know, I love dearly. And I just decided that I'm going to do something, and hopefully by me accomplishing something that I thought was impossible and that other people see as a pretty big accomplishment, maybe I could use that platform to affect other veterans as well.
Just so you know, when we're done, this interview will go up on YouTube. So I don't know if you're active on social media. I'll shoot you the link. But people should listen to this because, first of all, it's an awesome interview. I don't have a whole lot of part in it other than just asking, you know, what I think is interesting questions. But, Charlie, I got to tell you, you know, your story's a remarkable one, and it's an awesome one. So how do you touch other people? Do you get email? Do people kind of get in touch with you, and then you do it that way?
Well, now that I'm back, I mean, I've only been back for a very short time, and so I'm really trying to figure out how to reach the most people. Now, locally in my community, you know, I got back, and the next weekend there was this event in the adaptive community, not even for veterans, just people that don't really get out and maybe climb mountains. And so there's this area called Table Rock, and I went out and helped 22 people. Me showing up, I guess, because I just climbed Everest. Helped 22 people that climb this hill that's just outside of town. Because they've never done it. I'm on Warriors to Wellness, which is a local nonprofit here. It pairs veterans with childhood cancer patients, kind of like a big brother, big sister program, but with veterans from the community and children that are going through something pretty profound.
Right.
And so I work with them closely. I'm actually got a meeting today for Warriors to Wellness.
Okay.
And any way that I can reach out, and whether it's through just showing up and having lunch with somebody or somebody in contact with me and say, hey, I really need some help. Like, I would love to reach as many people as I can, just talking to them. Hopefully that they see that I was capable of it. And if they need a buddy, like here locally, like if they need a buddy, I'm going to go hike with them, do whatever they want. Like, I just want to be there as a support structure for veterans.
Awesome. My guest is Charlie Linville, and talking about ways he's going to impact. All right, now let's talk about training to go to Everest. First of all, how did the idea of going about it? Because that's not like, hey, look, maybe I'll go fishing this weekend, or I'll go get ready to climb Everest. I'm not exactly sure. So how does that thing get on your radar?
It gets on my radar because another EOD tech, Mark Zambone, who is with First EOD Company, got injured about 2 weeks before I did and sang it just out of Bob Jackson. And he recovered. He's a double above the knee amputee. And his recovery process included getting hooked up with a veterans organization called Heroes Project.
Okay.
And the Heroes Project trained Mark to climb Kilimanjaro. And watching Mark's progression go from the normal physical therapy room to getting out in the mountains of California and really pushing himself and his prosthetic limbs to new heights, and seeing just kind of what it is. You can see that he walks different, that he's looks different. You know, he is in shape now, and all the things that it provided him, I really wanted. And Mark got back and said, "Fierce Project is looking for other veterans to climb mountains." And we're just sitting around a beer at a buddy's wedding. And said, is anybody interested? And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, give them my number and my email, and I would love to discuss it. So whether they accept me or not, I don't know, but I would love to discuss it. So that's what Mark did, and the Heroes Project got in contact and actually came down and kind of did an interview with me and said, we would like to climb a mountain with you. Now, it was never originally supposed to be Mount Everest, but, again, this is where the punk comes back. The smart ass comes back into the room. They selected a mountain which was Carson's Pyramid, which is a just really cool mountain that just sticks up out of the jungle in Papua New Guinea. And I did some research on it, and it looked like a great adventure, right? Like, oh yeah,
right.
I'm supposed to this jungle with these guys and the gourds in their groins, and
right.
It's going to be fun. But as far as is it physically going to test my metal? I don't think so. And so at an event, I popped off my mouth and said, yeah, Carson's great, but, you know, Everest would be better. And so that's really how it came around. About a month later, the Heroes Project called me up like, oh, you want Everest? Okay, you got it. Start training.
Wow. So just being a punk got you to Everest.
My mouth got me to get a chance at Everest, yeah. Absolutely.
Way to clean that up. The So you start training. So what's how do you train to go to Everest? Describe, you know, you said 6 hours in the gym. Describe that. What would you do?
So the Heroes Project has a sponsor, Equinox, which is big gyms on the East and West Coast.
Right.
And Equinox agreed to give me a personal trainer. So I got a personal trainer for 2 hours in the morning. And, I knew how to go to the gym, but I never had a personal trainer in my life. And holy moly. I mean, when I say I got smoked for 2 hours every day. Then I would take a break after that horrible pace fest. And I would go to a hypoxic chamber. And so if you don't know what a hypoxic chamber is, instead of adding oxygen into the air, there's big generators and they remove the oxygen. So as I was doing a spin class, as I was cycling in this chamber, the oxygen is replicating what it's like to be at 18 to 20,000 feet. So I'm pretty much, you know, suffocating myself while riding a stationary bike.
So, but because of you've been a Marine, you're used to being miserable and doing stupid stuff, so this all made sense.
Yeah, it was just kind of, you know, oh, I know how to do this. I know how to feel like crap every day and do exercise. Yeah, I got this.
So talk about how did your body adapt to that? Did slowly but surely your body get used to it? Because I will tell you what, it would amaze people to know that with the amount of weight that Marines put on and in places like Al Anbar, Fallujah, Ramadi, and then the Helmand Province, and it being 125 to 130 degrees, and there's not air conditioning in the Humvees. I don't know if everybody knows that, but there's surprisingly very few heat casualties. You would think that, you know, guys falling out all the time, and the answer is no. They get used to it and they know how to do it. So did your body begin to adapt to that lack of oxygen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I slept in one as well. I mean, so for at least 8 hours a day, I slept at, the same altitude, 18,000 feet. And so The first, you got to creep your way up. The first 2 weeks, it wasn't, it's not fun. I mean, you don't feel good and you become a lack of energy and your body is trying to figure out what's going on. But after that, you kind of see a switch in yourself and you start being able to operate in these extreme conditions. And much like operating in 120 degree heat, you know, you just adapt and overcome. And I think that's one of the greatest things the Marine Corps gave me in this whole thing is, the perspective to know that it's not that bad. And no matter what, you're going to push through.
So how long is the training before you're ready to go? And you made several attempts. So how many attempts at Everest did you make?
Made three. So in 14, there was the avalanche on the south side of the mountain that killed 16 Sherpas and caused some unrest.
Right.
So the mountain was closed down that year. Quite depressing. All that hard work for nothing. I had to go home. But at the same time, it was a huge tragedy. It was a big deal on the mountain. So I understood. I respected the Sherpa community and that we weren't climbing that year. I get it. Okay, go home. 15, we made the commitment to go back, and, you know, it's not just the work, all the hard work for myself that goes into it. I mean, the organization I'm going with is a nonprofit, so we have to raise the money. Everest is cheap, right? So it's like raising the money from LA and these communities, and really across the nation, everybody that helped with their support. And so raising the money and then doing all the hard work, and we got to base camp on the north side, so we went to Tibet in 2015. And we were over there for a short time, and bam, you know, the huge earthquake struck, which devastated Nepal. And so they were like, well, obviously we're not climbing now. Chinese shut the mountain down in Tibet. Nepal closed the mountain down on the south side, and we flew back to Kathmandu and helped out in the relief effort.
Wow. And then that takes you to this year.
And then this year, I trained harder, longer, put my heart and soul into it. And this year, I don't know, I just had like good vibes, like it's going to happen this year. I mean, everybody was, you know, gung-ho, and every turn, I just felt like it was going to happen. And when I finally clipped into the ropes at the base of Everest, it's like, yep, it's on, let's get it done.
How long is the training period that, you know, so when you say I began training, so when you get out your calendar and say I'm starting this date, you know, that'll put me ready for this date, how long is that period that you get ready for?
So in 15, when I came home, I took the summer off, spent the summer with my family, and then right at the end of September, it became, all right, now I get back into the swing of it. I mean, Everest is coming up. So, I mean, it was like 6 months really of good training. Well, 4 months of good training and then 2 solid months of intense 6 days a week, at least 6 to 12 hours a day. I say 12 hours a day because Saturday was my climb day. So, I mean, I went on 12-hour climbs in the mountains. And then Sunday was a rest day. I mean, I devoted my entire, I mean, I was eating, sleeping, and breathing Everest. Like, I'm not going to fail this year.
So talk to us about going up the mountain.
Oh man, what a good venture. Words can't describe it. It's just, so you start at Everest Base Camp, 17,000 feet, and you have to start climbing up, to Advanced Base Camp, which is 21,000 feet. And the whole journey is just this 14-mile uphill through just far out that you couldn't, I can't even describe unless you see it. And we got drone footage of it that's going to be in the documentary. But it's just this out of this world landscape where you got these huge ice kind of tentes that are like hundreds of feet tall on the left and right of you. And then you're on this rock moraine kind of path that goes right through the center all the way up. And as you get to Advanced Base Camp, I mean, your body is 21,000 feet, so you're just, you can barely breathe. I mean, walking to the toilet is like laboring. I don't even want to go down there right now. Nope.
Really?
It took me about 2.5 weeks to get ready to get go higher up the mountain. I mean, just to be able to function at that altitude.
My guess this morning, Charlie Linville, we're talking, he first wounded veteran to get to the top of Mount Everest, and Marine, Staff Sergeant, Infantryman, EOD, and now kind of a veterans activist, and talked to him about going up Everest. So you're at one of the upper advanced base camps, and then talk to us about getting to the top. That must have been crazy.
Yeah, so from ABC, Advanced Base Camp, it's a 5-day climb to the top. And that's after you've done your acclimatization and you're ready. I mean, there's this whole, we were there for a month and a half process to get ready for that 5 days, right?
Right.
So the five, summit day comes or summit push comes, and it's like, okay, time to go. And you begin your ascent of this just monstrous mountain. And every camp you get to, you get higher and higher up the mountain, and it becomes more labor-intensive. It's harder to breathe. You start using supplemental oxygen, and the steepness of the mountain, it's really hard to describe. I mean, it's not like nothing I've ever been on before in my entire life. I mean, you look down, and you realize that if you fall, it's just lights out. It's over. Game over. Done. But you have these just amazing views everywhere you look, and we had great weather as far as not like many clouds. It was really windy every day, but
right.
Man, I could see out for miles, which was fantastic. Then summit day, you know, the day that is D-Day, right? It comes down to being in the death zone. If you don't know what the death zone is, it's above 26,000 feet. Your body is essentially dying slowly but surely. If you didn't have supplemental oxygen, your lungs are slowly filling up with fluid, your brain's slowly swelling, and your body's no longer digesting the food in your stomach. You're dying. And so, you gotta get up and down as fast as possible. And that's summit day. So you gotta go up this incredibly steep and rocky, wall, and you gotta traverse across, the top of Everest. If you Google a picture of Everest on the north side, you can kind of see how long the traverse is. You just don't go from the bottom all the way to the top. You kind of go from the left side, and you have to traverse this long ridge and then go over different steps to three steps, the first step, the second step. experience.
So you're finally standing on the top, and what was your first thought once you got to the top?
Well, so to get to the top, you have to pass this part called the Tejedral. The Tejedral is right just below the summit, but it's a narrow rock outcropping, and there's probably about 6 to 8 inches for your foot to walk. And then on your right side is a mile drop down into Tibet. Right? So if you're afraid of heights, you know, don't look down. and so I remember coming around there and just being like elated that, you know, I didn't fall on this prosthetic limb that's like walking on marble. So it's all rock. There's no snow right there.
Right.
So taking a cramp on a walk down this rock was horrible. And I remember coming out of there and you make this left turn and go up about another 100 feet and then a right turn. And you're right on the summit ridge and you can see the top. And I just, at that point, I had made Everest. Like I wasn't even on the top of the world yet and I had made Everest because it was so close.
Right.
And I just, in my mind, I remember thinking that I can't believe I'm here. Like I was in disbelief because of the 3 years it had taken me to get there and then all the hard work and everything that it had taken. And for me to be an amputee, you know, it was this really surreal feeling once they get, I got to the top. You know, I screamed at the top of my lungs because it's the culmination of my journey since my injury that I just got to the roof of the world as a war-wounded amputee. And many people told me it was impossible and I couldn't do it and I was going to die. And there I was, did something that nobody else thought I was capable of, but yet knowing it in my heart the whole time that I was. And so that was a big moment for me.
And got there because you're a punk.
Punk, Marine, you know, got there.
All of it.
Because I was ready.
All of it. That's an incredible story, Charlie. And so you took the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor to the top of Everest. That's awesome.
Yeah, that and Old Glory were the two most important things that went to the top of me.
What's up there? What's up at the top? Is there landmark up there? Is there anything up there?
It changes over the years, so when the jet stream is there, its winds are blowing like 150, 200 miles an hour, right? And so the snow drift changes every year. So the summit's never quite the same. There used to be this huge glass box with Buddha inside of it
right. That
the Sherpas took up there back in like 2005.
Right.
But, I mean, that's gone. That's completely gone. And now it's marked with a pole every year, whoever gets up there first, and then there's always prayer flags up there because prayer flags are a huge part of Tibetan and Nepali culture.
Okay. All right. The Charlie Linville, our guest, he just got done 3 weeks ago going to the top of Mount Everest. Talk about coming home. Obviously, an international story. What's it been like since you've done it? Has it been what you thought it would be? And really, you know, it sounds like you said you needed this in your life, but also one of the byproducts was going to be able to use it as a forum to help other veterans. So has it been that?
It definitely has. I mean, I've received some great emails and letters, and I kind of said that, you know, I don't really expect it to affect everybody, but if I just changed one person's life, then all the pain and suffering and everything I did to train to get ready for Everest was worth it. And I've gotten several emails and letters recently that said, you know, your story inspired me to get up and do something, you know, get up and start cycling again, get up and start walking again, which was really humbling for myself. Like, this is really why I did it. And for somebody to write, tell me that really means a lot. And now I just get to keep doing that. And so, I mean, that's a good thing in my world. Like, I would really love to just go out and inspire people, and I'm going to keep going and doing things in my own life in order to show people that maybe the previously perceived impossible is possible. And I'll show you why it's possible, because I just did this, which means whatever you want to do, you can. It's just a matter of your brain housing group and your heart. Your body is just, you can adapt. Whatever your body needs, you can adapt. But if you get your brain straight and your heart straight, you can accomplish anything.
You know, Charlie, last week we had a girl named Sarah Rudder on, and she's a former Marine, got out as a lance corporal. She had injured her foot, I don't know, in doing something in the Marine Corps. They were med boarding her out. She got promoted from PSC to lance corporal on September 11th at the headquarters Marine Corps just above the Pentagon, the annex over there. She's outside in the smoking area when the plane smashes in the Pentagon. She goes down there. She steps in some hole and jacks her bad ankle up even worse. She winds up getting put out of the Marine Corps. And then for 13 years, she wrestles with it. And they finally said, hey, you have nerve damage in there now. We can fuse it. You'll take pain meds the rest of your life, or you can have it amputated. She has it amputated. And she said, they told her, you know, you'll walk with a limp first and all this stuff. She said, I spent 8 hours in physical therapy the first day so I could walk without a limp. And then I was determined to get those 13 years back. And she said, but the hardest step was the first step I took, was to get off the couch and to get moving after I had my ankle amputated. And you sound like you're saying the exact same thing, that once you got yourself moving, all the things that made you the Marine that you were, the guy that you were, the punk that you were, all those things kicked in and you returned to being the person that you are.
That's exactly it. I mean, that fire is still deep inside of every Marine. I know it is, because that's who you had to be to join the Marine Corps. I mean, you just didn't show up and be like, I think I want to be a Marine, maybe. It doesn't work that way. So, and once you get that ego globe and anchor, and you carry the title Marine, I mean, you carry that for the rest of your life, and that fire is still inside of you. So all of the Marines out there that, you know, are struggling, I know what you're going through, but it's really taking that first step, because that fire and that passion is still burning in your belly, and it's get out the door, and whatever you want to do in life, you're going to accomplish. I have that faith in all Marines.
And it started for you just as simple as taking your daughters to the park and playing with them, and those were the first steps.
Yep. Get my prosthetic limb and having my daughter look at me, so we can go to the park now, right, Dad?
Nice. She knew what was up.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, we can, baby. All right, let's go do this. And wanting to push her on the swings and chase her around. And that's it. I never looked back.
Awesome. Charlie, do you have people that are looking to follow you, or do you have any place that they would go to whether it be a Facebook page or a Twitter account to follow you? Because you have an awesome story, and I know that your story is just starting, as crazy as that is to say, but I think we both know that you have bigger things ahead of you in life. Do you have any way that people can follow you or contact you if they want to?
Yeah, I've got an athlete Facebook page.
Okay.
It's just USMC retired Staff Sergeant Charlie Linville.
Okay. And that's how people can follow you or message you.
Yeah, follow me on Facebook, and anything that I do, I'm trying to. I didn't do Facebook for years, so I'm trying to get into it now.
All right. No, let me tell you. I mean, I'm with you. I wasn't the biggest person, but you know, this forum, you know, the way you get the word out, honestly, is Facebook. And as every Marine, you know, sees it and says, oh, man, I'll like that, it goes to all his Marine buddies, and it just spreads like you can't believe. So I'm in the same boat, learning.
Yeah, learning. Anyway, I put it all in there, and then I think soon, within the next 2 weeks, charlielinville.com is going to come online so that I can, get the message out there to people.
Well, first of all, on behalf of every Marine that's listening and every Marine that is not listening, that should be, we're proud as shit of you, Charlie, in terms of taking all of us up there. And there was no surprise when we saw that a Marine was the first guy who did it. And I laughed when we first talked and you said it was important to you because you knew there was Army guys trying, but it was important to you to get there first.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the spirit of a Marine, though, right? Like, the rivalry is deep, and I believe the Marine Corps is the best branch in the military, so I wasn't letting the Army flag get up there first.
I ask this of every Marine that comes on. Can you put into words the courage and selflessness that you've seen in combat, in your combat deployments, that you, from fellow Marines and our Navy corpsmen?
No, I don't think that's something you can make tangible. I mean, it's such an amazing thing to watch when you go into combat, and it's just human nature and knowing the bond that's bred in the Marine Corps. I mean, these are, at one time they were complete strangers, and now, you know, you don't even know the Marine from a different battalion, but because he wears that uniform, because he wears that name tape across his chest, that's your brother, and you'd live and die for him. And to watch that type of selflessness and heroic behavior is a thing of beauty. I mean, as weird as that sounds in war, it really is. And to be a part of that and to be have been in the Marine Corps and be part of that brotherhood for life is one of my greatest honors in life.
Well, Charlie, first of all, a great honor for us to have you on today. And the conversation from your combat experiences as your leadership and then your rehab and then the conversation all the way up to Mount Everest. Awesome, awesome stuff this morning. Thank you for coming on All Marine Radio. And if there's anything, anytime you ever want to get the word out or the message out, just shoot me a text message. You come on here anytime you want. You can own the program.
Oh, absolutely. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks for having me on today.
No. Charlie, it was my privilege, and I know everybody listening would say the same thing. What a great story. We're really proud of you, and thanks for giving up a little bit of your time today.
Absolutely.
All right, bud. Thank you. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
All right. That is Staff Sergeant Charlie Linville right here on All Marine Radio. And when we come back, we're going to do a little bit of a leadership roundtable in terms of the best leadership advice you ever got from somebody. So we will go ahead and do that, and we'll be right back on a awesome Tuesday edition. I'll tell you what, this show's awesome. Ben Connable this morning and then Charlie Linville like that? Nobody does radio like this. Great men doing great things, smart guys, tough guys, accomplished guys. Love this. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.